Peter Dow, founder of Finance Technology and co-host of the Signal versus Noise podcast. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So Ed, the biggest themes as you guys have presented in your 2026 US economic outlook are a white swan housing crisis possibly coming for the US, the stock market AI bubble beginning to crack, and China entering the acute phase of its real estate and demographic crisis. I'd like to touch on all of these with you today, but I'd like to start with getting your thoughts on if war with Iran distracts or accelerates these factors.
So the war with Iran, the biggest risk from the war with Iran that I see is if the Straits of Hormuz get closed and oil stays above 80 for any length of time. This is going to be hard for people to understand, but at this point in the credit cycle, when you have an oil shock, and if it sustains, it has to sustain itself for like a month or so. It's actually deflationary because the consumer is already tapped, the job market is rolling over, and credit card defaults are going up, mortgages are under pressure, car loans or defaults are going up. So this would be the death knell for the consumer. People may not remember this. Everyone talks about the housing crisis, but there was an oil price spike. There was a lot of speculation. It was peak oil, and oil in 2008 accelerated very fast up to $140 per barrel, peaked in June of 08, and then started collapsing. That kind of was the last nail in the coffin for the consumer, and then the housing crisis really began in earnest. So the biggest risk from the Iran situation is the sustained oil price above 80, which would ultimately be deflationary. So that adds an element of risk to the situation, but the case we presented in our outlook in January, those fundamentals are in motion and nothing can derail them because this is just the endogenous cycle to the economy and to the credit cycle. And we're now starting to see cracks in private credit, which, begins a series of feedback loops.
So there's so many things to touch on there, obviously, Ed, but let's start with the housing crisis. You guys said, and the last time I interviewed you, you were saying it was starting last year and it's only going to accelerate. Is this driven primarily by, let's say, the weakness of the US consumer, or does it have, what are the other factors that have to do with it that really propel it forward?
So we printed, a tremendous amount of money during COVID, and then the Fed also bought $1.5 trillion in mortgage-backed securities off banks' balance sheets. So that freed up a lot of capital for banks to lend, and there was a mini housing boom. So we had some gilding going on, and then we also had the illegal alien situation during the Biden administration, which plopped about 20 million people into the country. So we had a multifamily housing boom. Those have all peaked and are rolling over. And we also have the policies under the Biden administration are going the other way, meaning the border's closed. So there's no new net inflow of people putting pressure on rents. I'm not necessarily saying that, illegals were buying homes or that did occur, but it was mostly supporting the housing market through the rental market. That's all the indicators are rolling over. New permits for housing peaked in 2022. And we should have already seen a housing correction, but what kept that going was a multifamily housing build, which takes longer than a year to build those units. Usually a single family home gets built in a year. So that as those projects are in process, there's construction, there's economic activity, but that's all coming to an end. And the housing, I call it a white swan because it should be apparent to anybody with eyes and ears. The data is all going south. The affordability crisis is there, and it's manifesting itself in this time series that we track called homes for sale versus homes sold. And if you look at the long-term chart, those two time series generally track each other. Since 2023, there has been homes for sale has been going up and homes sold has been going down. So there's this big gap. So the housing and new home pending sales is at an all-time low. So what's going on? The market's frozen, and the sellers still have unrealistic price expectations. And so there's no market activity. And that primarily it's due to affordability. During COVID and the inflation, property taxes have gone up, the cost of insurers has gone up, you know, more defaults, more slowing in the economic activity, meaning household formation is going to slow. And that's in process. If you take a look at the chart of lumber, lumber is, I think, plumbing. Lumber chart looks awful. So this is a slow rolling thing. And then it'll accelerate at the end. If you remember in the 08 crisis, you know, it was started unwinding in 07. And the real estate professionals and the fixed income professionals that held a bunch of these subprime bonds said everything was fine. And the real estate market's not an auction market. It's not traded daily. So once it hits the headlines and the mainstream media declares that there's a housing problem and a crisis, you were closer to the end than we are at the beginning. So it's in motion, and it's going to, you know, affect, you know, 20% of the consumer economy is homes. And so that's a big chunk of the economy. So that's one pressure point that is slowly unwinding. The jobs are going the wrong way. We basically had last month a non-farm payroll revision down of about 1 million jobs. So we had that in 24, revised down about 800,000, and then 1 million in 25. So the job creation that everybody was touting really wasn't there. And now we're seeing layoffs occur. And so it's just, this is classic cycle. The income of the consumer is too low, they're strapped, and eventually it's going to affect the economy and the stock market at some point. That's just one risk factor. So that's one. We would get a problem with just that one factor, then add on the AI bubble and record stock market valuations, and then throw in China. Mm-hmm. So we're potentially a .com smushed together with a housing problem, and then throw in China turmoil that's going to affect, you know, Asia, which will have feedback loops into the U.S.
Well, before we move on to the other two there, Ed, how do you think that the effect or the job of mainstream media to highlight a problem like a housing crisis has changed over time? You know, we've seen not only, let's say, mainstream media, but also the jobs number reporting, for example, non-farm payrolls or CPI as being pointed to as being, you know, numbers that don't represent reality. So is it possible that, you know, media isn't covering a housing crisis that would shake consumer confidence in the same way, as you put?
There's been a concerted effort since the great financial crisis to not create panic. Because a lot of, I think during the great financial crisis, there was a lot of panic on TV. And after that, there was a concerted effort not to talk negatively about the economy really ever. And if you look at CNBC, they're cheerleaders for everything. And you know, I get it, but that, you know, if you're a professional investor, you know, it's kind of worthless to you. Let's talk about the non-farm payroll numbers. Numbers, a monthly estimate. And it's done through a survey of 600,000 businesses. The actual numbers called the quarterly census earnings and wages, which is done in arrears. It usually comes out 9 months after. And that's the actual number. That's the real hiring and wages and what really happened that's collected from, you know, the 16 million employers. So that's reality. And in my professional life, most of us in the investing world didn't even know what the QCEW was. It didn't matter, because it was, you know, a book report that showed what we already knew happened, because the non-farm payroll number used to basically estimate close enough to what reality was over time. There were always revisions statistically how bad, for it missed reality, actual reality, by 4 standard deviations. And in 2025, it missed by 8 standard deviations. For the last 2 years, the number's been virtually worthless in predicting reality. What that says to me is that there's a lot of capital that's been following that number, and maybe is starting to wake up to the fact that it's not the number that we need to look at. And everybody, in my humble opinion, is very overweight equities on an asset allocation basis versus bonds. And if the U.S. economy is slowing, and once this realization kind of gets into the, you know, the mainstream mindset, and it will eventually, there's going to be a very quick repositioning, and you're going to see what I think is going to be a fairly fast you know, reallocation from stocks to bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds and notes. And when that happens is anyone's guess, but it's closer now than it has been in a long, long time. A lot of people point to the stock market and say, oh, it's been hitting new all-time highs. But if you look at the chart, it's gone nowhere since October. Momentum in the market is gone. There's clearly a rotation into other stocks suggesting that, oh, well, Trump's plan is working. Well, is it? I mean, the manufacturing jobs aren't coming yet. The tariffs just got, you know, the Supreme Court ruled against the tariffs. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And the employment numbers are certainly not showing that manufacturing is taking off. So there's going to be a valley at some point, and it's coming. And when people point to the stock market, it's literally gone nowhere since October of last year.
Mm-hmm. So it has been pointed to that due for an ugly stock market correction, Ed, with being pointed at being caused by the AI bubble. Why do you think that actually comes to head this year, or like what is the catalyst for it?
Well, I think the cracks are already beginning. There was a lot of startup companies that were funded with junk bonds, and the credit markets realized that started to question the growth rates of the revenues, and the revenues never came for a lot of these telecom companies that paused the financing, which paused the CapEx, which then eventually fed into the Ciscos and Nortels and Lucents of the world, which were highly overvalued to begin with. Just to, you know, if you bought Cisco at the top in the dot-com bubble in 2000, you just got back to break even if you held on to that stock. The stock just finally went to where it was, you know, 26 years later. So that's a long time to wait. And let's look at the AI situation. We're starting to see people questioning the time to revenue for these AI startups, especially OpenAI and others. And yes, they have phenomenal growth rates, but they also had phenomenal amounts of CapEx. So the credit markets are asking, ooh, what's the ROI on this? Maybe the adoption rate isn't as fast as I thought. This is a lot of capital, and the return might not be there. So you've seen deals downsized. You've seen credit default swaps on Oracle bonds go up, on CoreWeave bonds go up. Private credit's been instrumental in funding a lot of this AI, and private credit's under assault. There's a lot of so-called run on the bank, these public funds, and now they're gating those funds. So I think the credit markets are already starting to revolt. Question of when that all pauses in the CapEx cycle, and at some point NVIDIA is going to announce that they missed their earnings for some reason, and then the stock will get hit. So I think it's in motion. We're just waiting for people to realize it.
You mentioned private credit a couple times here, and I want to dig in a little bit more on, let's say, making it easier for the average listener to understand the difference between private credit and that credit cycle and the credit cycle or the public credit cycle that we normally talk about.
Yeah. So after the great financial crisis, there was a lot of banking regulations. And so banks didn't really want to lend to a lot of the companies out there. So a way of financing growth and businesses that maybe a bank didn't want to lend to directly. And they did a lot of creative deals, a lot of creative financing. And like anything, the good deals were already picked over early on, but the sector has grown from a tiny amount to, it's globally now, people estimate it's between 3 and 4 trillion globally. In the US, it's at least 2 trillion. And the last 2 years has seen tremendous growth. A lot of the commercial bank lending the last 2 years from the JP Morgans and the Bank of Americas has been to what's called non-depository financial institutions. So the banks are lending money to these guys that then, you know, do their financial engineering and then do deals and then place these deals in insurance companies, pension funds, their own private credit funds. And the biggest problem with the private credit is it's not necessarily a point in the cycle where the excesses occur. And that's where we are right now. And the problem with private credit is it's very opaque. There's diverse portfolios. What's the collateral? What's the deal look like? As opposed to the subprime crisis and the mortgage crisis in the great financial situation, at least the underlying collateral was a home. Yes, there was a lot of fraud then, but at least it was a homogenous asset that people could basically figure out. And there's a lot of opportunities and people could price those. I suspect as we go through this cycle, it's going to be more difficult, and the bid-ask spreads as we unwind this problem are going to be much higher, because everyone's going to have to go into each deal and bond specifically. It's going to require a lot of work and effort, as opposed to homes. You can kind of figure out what a home's worth. A lot of studies had already been done on homes, mortgage aging, regional, where the bonds are located, where the homes are located. So it remains to be seen whether the banks can absorb these write-offs. I'm not worried about the private credit guys, because, you know, they are what they are. They'll blow off and they'll have their problems, but they're not systemic. You have to worry about the blowback to the banks. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen when a $2 trillion market gets into problems? It creates feedback loops. So credit starts to tighten. People don't make loans. People start, you know, rather than doing new deals, and credit is the lifeblood of the economy, they start looking to shore up the losses. And so there's kind of a credit contraction and credit freezes. And that's kind of where we're headed.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about is, you know, redemptions on a lot of those funds have been halted. So does that, you know, that is, let's say, the first piece of that puzzle that starts those feedback loops, right?
Bonds are an over-the-counter market, and they usually sit in portfolios, and there's not a problem until the end of the credit cycle, when a lot of these bonds start to, you know, some of them, a percentage of them start to default, and a lot of those bonds were bought on leverage. So then it starts to unwind. So people need liquidity. They want to sell these bonds, but they can't because they're, you know, the bid-ask spread's too wide. It takes a while for these, you know, you just don't click a button and hit the eject. You have to have another buyer on the other side. And we call those bonds the trade by appointment only. So it's a liquidity problem. And so when the liquidity problem hits and people are overlevered and margin calls begin, they then sell what they can, not what they want. So it spreads to other assets like the equity markets, spreads to even gold and silver. People sell what they can. The Fed is way too tight. The Fed is behind the curve on this. And real interest rates are still 1%, which means the Fed is well above neutral. So money is tight in the economy. And the economy is doing well. It means the economy is rolling over. So I expect the Fed to play catch up at some point.
So Ed, all of these factors taken together, does that present a disinflationary environment for, let's say, the short to medium term, followed by another round of printing and another injection of liquidity, which lights inflation again?
Yeah. So here's the trick. We're going to get a disinflationary / deflationary scare. Risk assets will sell off. The Fed will act, but it takes time for that liquidity to work its way into the system. So that's why, if you look at the charts from 2000 and 2008, the Fed was cutting all the way down to zero and asset prices still continued to drop, because it takes 18 months for that to start to work its way into the economy. So there'll be this deflationary scare, which presents the opportunity if you're prepared, meaning like you have, you know, cash, you know, dry powder cash in your portfolio, and then you take advantage of these opportunities, understanding that the Fed is going to print and there'll be a recovery and there'll be another inflationary, you know, problem. That's what I suspect is going to happen. But, you know, to think that the Fed can save us is not how the game works. The credit is going to get destroyed pretty quickly. Then the Fed has to create new credit. Then it takes a while to work its way into the economy. So, you know, stock prices eventually, given the valuations and given what we see fundamentally, we think the U.S. stock market could get a nice 30 to 50% drawdown. And anywhere between 30 and 50%, you start nibbling and reallocating some of the cash. If you have cash, if you're 100% equities, you probably don't believe a word I'm saying. And, you know, good luck to you is my humble opinion.
You mentioned the idea that when, you know, stress hits the system, that everything gets sold no matter what to cover margin calls. I've also heard you say that you think that gold and silver are kind of due for a consolidation period here. What is your longer term outlook on the metals? And is that a place that you see as being still a safe haven in times of stress like this?
Gold and silver had tremendous moves leading up to this, which I think we're kind of discounting. What we're seeing is that there is a credit event coming. Gold and silver were discounting a little bit of that. And then they had tremendous moves, and now they're consolidating. In a Lehman type event, which we're not calling, gold and silver could get sold. I would view that as a tremendous buying opportunity. I view gold and silver not as trading. They should be 5 to 10% of anyone's portfolio, physical gold and silver. Buy on the dips. Long term, we think gold's going to 10,000 by 2030, silver much higher. And the reason being that there is going to be, and this has been discussed by not myself, but just about everybody in the financial community, a new monetary system is coming at some point. And gold has become tier one capital at banks again, where they can create money from gold. Gold was downgraded to a tier three capital after the petrodollar was introduced. So watch what the banks are doing. It's going to be part of the new market. Whatever that looks like, don't know, but gold and silver will be a part of it. So long term, I like them. But if someone said, hey, Ed, I got $500,000. I want to go buy gold today or silver today. I'd say, look, take that $500,000 and like dollar cost average it over a year. Don't put, you know, it's already had a huge move. And for me personally, I'd love to see it consolidate because that would be healthy and kind of go sideways for 6 to 12 months. If it has another parabolic move like the one we just saw last year, that would be concerning. That means something really bad's coming, and that might be an ending move for gold and silver in the short term. But right now, I like the price to be healthy long term for the technicals and the fundamentals. What you don't want to see is you don't want to see gold run to 9,000 in 3 months. That would, you know, that would be a take some profit signal, in my humble opinion.
Right. I've also been considering this idea that gold becomes part of this new monetary system. Would it serve all of those that are holding lots of gold, like all of these central banks, to have it as high as possible in order to increase the, let's say, the amount of wealth when they are ready to move to that new system?
I think so, but that'll be determined by market forces and what's going on with fiat currency at the time. There's been a lot of negative talk on the US and the dollar. The dollar is the cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry. It bottomed during the great financial crisis, and it's been in a stealth bull market since then, with higher highs and higher lows. It broke the trend line recently, and everyone suggested the dollar was going to fall apart. What I think happened is the dollar has about what we call a four-year cycle from one low to the next low. And this four-year cycle has been bullish, meaning the four-year cycle low is lower than the next four-year cycle low. So it's been higher highs, higher lows. I think we just saw potentially what we call an extended four-year cycle low in the dollar that we just put in recently. The dollar is rallying, and I think the dollar is going to be one of the best currencies to be in the next 6 to 12 months, just due to cycles and what's going to happen globally. And, you know, look, if this Iran situation continues and there's an oil problem, it's going to hurt the emerging markets worse than it does the US for sure.
And as we talk about this new system, new, you know, monetary system, you have a unique perspective as somebody that has previously worked at BlackRock. Do you think that the move towards tokenization of assets is something that is misunderstood as being a big threat to the average person, or does it serve a particular purpose for the system, let's say, to transact in a more efficient manner?
Ability to abuse the tokenization is the thing I don't like. You know, there's no privacy, how it's controlled, who controls it, who benefits from it. There's definitely talk of the CBDCs. Everybody kind of understands that that is a potential dead on arrival because of the control issues. Stable coins, which they're pushing, and I think the UN is going to, you know, it'll be the JP Morgan coin, the Bank of America coin. And the problem we have with that is that it'll be indirectly controlled by the government through the back door. And it'll give the government the excuse, these are private institutions, they can do what they want. Just like they did with the censorship model. Remember, the US government was basically censoring people with NGOs and Google and putting pressure on Facebook to do what they wanted. and then claiming, well, it's not really censorship from the government, and this is, these are private institutions. So I worry about a lot of these things. That's why we have to think about privacy. And I don't know if you've noticed, but you know, Bitcoin's had quite a sell-off since October. What's outperformed is privacy coins have been doing better than the general crypto market. So there seems to be this, you know, shift back to privacy again, which my partner wrote a paper on that. He's more the Bitcoin crypto expert than I am. The system return on like a Bitcoin, and then consumers and everybody else has privacy coins, you know, kind of a hybrid system.
Ed, when, you know, as we're talking about the US dollar being strong and the idea of that you've presented that you think that bonds are going to be one of the better performing assets here, how do we basically think about that in the context of this war? You know, there is an idea that the US needs to dramatically resupply all of their armaments and that this is going to cost a lot of money. War is inherently very expensive. How do you think those two forces balance out within the bond market here?
Well, the bond market cares about two things and two things only: growth expectations and inflation expectations. If we're right on our economic call, including China, growth expectations are going to decline, bond market trades on. So there'll be a bid to the long end as this unfolds, and rates will go lower and risk assets will sell off and crowd into bonds. So counterintuitively, I expect deficits to widen into this next economic downturn. Counterintuitively, bonds will be fine because there'll be a flight to safety and the US government's not going bankrupt anytime soon. And yes, the deficit may widen, but inflation is going the wrong way into deflation, and the growth is slowing, which we believe it is. That's going to be the best place to be, in our humble opinion. And by the way, everybody's not there. Once this trade begins, if we're correct, which I believe we will be, it'll happen fairly quickly, and you've got to be kind of positioned for it. You can't chase it.
You mentioned China again there, Ed, and that's the one major factor we didn't kind of go through yet. Again, their entrance into this acute phase of their real estate and demographic crisis is something that you're pointing to as the reason for them being not a threat to the US, but, you know, contributing to a major correction here. Why are those problems centered in China such a risk factor to the US?
Yeah, so it's going to be contagion effect through their trading partners. So this will affect South Korea and Japan. And Japan already has a problem with their currency and their interest rates and their inflation and their, you know, their deficits. China is Japan's largest trading partner from both exports. When you add up exports and imports, the US is number two. So anything that happens to China is going to affect those two, which will have feedback loops to the US, the global economy, which will only add to the contagion. The real estate crisis started in 2020 when their demographics peaked, and new permits are down 70%, which is huge. What's been keeping their economy, now their internal consumption has been plummeting, but they've had long-lived construction projects that are now starting to roll over. And that's manifesting into net fixed investment, which is now year-over-year growth rate of zero. Other than the COVID blip, which was temporary, that's the first time it's happened in, you know, since we've been tracking the data. Their GDP last quarter was 4.5%, the lowest in the last 3 years. And their electricity consumption is approaching potentially year-over-year growth. The internal wheels of China are slowing, but what do we have now? We have trade wars. There's a reason we have trade wars, because since 2020, to make up for the slowing of their internal economy, they've been ramping up the exports. That's how they've kept GDP growth around 5%. So now with China and Trump and trade wars, they're under pressure, tremendous pressure. And so they're going into the acute phase of their crisis. The good news is that China is a net creditor nation. So there won't be a situation where there's a currency crisis in China and foreign investors start exiting, they can fund this crisis internally, but it'll be very painful for them and more painful for their partners than so you won't be hearing about China collapsing or anything like that, but you're going to be hearing about what's happening to their trading partners.
Okay. So Ed, as we mentioned earlier, quality information is difficult to find. What do you keep an eye on a daily basis in order to try to get a more accurate picture of markets, of data, of what's happening in the world?
In our research, we look at a lot of leading indicators, and they're not, you know, you can't trade on them, but you can see where the winds are going to blow eventually and position yourself correctly. We're not short-term day traders. We're more opportunities and wait and have patience. But if you really want to, you know, if you're trying to get an idea of what's going on in the world, watch 3-month T-bills and a 2-year. And if 3-month T-bills start to run ahead of the Fed, or the 2-year starts to go down in yields very quickly, that means something is around the corner. So I wake up, the first thing I check is yields. I don't even care about what the stock market's doing. I check yields, the yield curve. I check what the dollar is doing, and then move over to, you know, the equity markets and then the news. Look, cycles are cycles, and demographics are very powerful. And China has a demographic problem, so they're in a deflationary death spiral. They're like much like Japan with the last 2 decades. That's what they're entering, and they're hitting the acute phase. When countries like China get into problems like this, it has geopolitical consequences.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Ed. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time today. Of course, your guys' reports are available at financetechnologies.com, but that's spelled with a P-H, I-N-A-N-C-E, technologies.com, and of course on X at Dowd Edward. Thanks so much for your time today, Ed. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.